anyone that needs to put their children to bed, it's kind of that time when they might appreciate going down, or at least having the space to do that. So we're getting into the rhythm with the song. I loved it the other day when I just breathed in and the song came from everybody at the same time, so then you don't have to hear my first note. So let's take a breath together and just get the stillness, and then all sing at the same moment, I hope, in one breath.
Oh, hush thee, my love. Oh, hush thee, my sweet love. Oh, hush thee, my lapwing, my sweet little bird. Come, fold your wings and seek your nest now. The
this last fall, in October, we lost an elder in our community who passed on, who worked with us for many years. His name was Jake Swamp, and he was pretty well known the world round for his peacemaking. And Jake, there was a time, you know, when I was 17 or so, I began to see some changes in my hometown, where the places that I went as a small boy to go play in the woods were slowly sort of being swallowed by development. And most people didn't see a problem with that. They all saw it as a good sign for the economy and, you know, more shops and more houses and more people, and there'd be more hustle and bustle, and somehow that was a good thing. And I suppose it is in some ways. I always wondered, at what point would it not be okay? Like, when the whole planet filled up completely, where would you then build? Would you start building up? Start building high rises and higher? And then would the planet start growing, getting larger because of the high rises stacked up on top of each other? At what point is growth not okay, you know, just to keep going and going and going? Like, I was thinking that at 17. I said, are we sure this is really the right thing? Has anyone projected the long-term results of this? But nobody was really talking about that. They were only talking about, you know, what it was going to do for us now. And I was arguing with everybody on philosophical grounds. I didn't think it was a great idea to have unquestioned, unchecked growth. I didn't think it was a very good idea. And for starters, I was already aware that my neighbors and friends, when I told them that it was a total disaster that the spring dried up and that the creek stopped flowing, no one would agree with me. And I couldn't understand why they didn't see a spring as something really special. Do you think a spring is special? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I felt like a spring was not just special. There was something like extra special about a spring. There was a lot of special things, but the spring seemed to have an extra specialness to it. And when it dried up, I was pretty well able to backtrack why that spring dried up, because the creek used to flow year-round, you know. Even in the summer when it was dry, the creek would keep flowing. So there was always little fish, and there was little frogs and salamanders in the creek behind my house. And then one year there wasn't. They were gone. And when I was younger, maybe 12 or 13, I saw my last box turtle, baby turtle, about this big around on its shell. And after that, I never saw one. And I noticed when I was younger, 10, 11, I used to see this corn snake all the time. And by the time I was 15, I couldn't find a corn snake. And then I couldn't find milk snakes. And then I found garter snakes and I found toads. But I couldn't find two different kinds of frogs that used to be there, you know. And I was watching the lights go out. That's what it felt like to me. It felt like the tide was going out. And I knew the tide wouldn't come back, you know. There was a sense that once the tide left, there was no way to get it to come back, because the tide that was receding was this tide of life that we didn't engineer, you know. The people hadn't made it, and so the people wouldn't know how to put it back anyway, you know. But I also noticed that in the creek, when the creek dried up and there was no more creek, whenever it rained, it flooded really intensely, but then when it stopped raining, it dried up. So it became a ditch, basically. It went from a creek to a ditch. And then the birds stopped visiting it. There were certain birds that would come in, herons and egrets, and not egrets, herons and, well, two different kinds of herons, green herons and blue herons. And I didn't see them anymore. And then I didn't see the kingfisher anymore, you know. And so there was things changing right before my eyes, and I knew they were changing. But I then began probably realizing, probably right around that time, 18 years old, that the reason nobody was worried about the creek was the same reason that there was nobody playing in the creek but me. You know, I was the only one playing back there. I started to realize I'm the only one whose footprints are back here. I'm the only one who's coming here anymore. The other kids have grown up and moved on, and the people who are left aren't going out past the edge of their lawn. Like, the lawn is where you stop. You dump your wheelbarrow loads of grass right there. So I went to the tracker school. That's when Tom Brown wrote his book, The Tracker, and he got famous. And he went from the guy up the street working on his Jeep because he couldn't afford mechanics. And he borrowed $20 from me all the time. And he never paid me back. But I knew darn well that he wasn't borrowing $20, because he was taking me to the Pine Barrens for the weekend, and we were having these amazing times in this beautiful place. And I always thought it was a small investment, $20, you know. Maybe it was a day's work at the liquor store, but it was worth it, you know, throwing beer cases in the cooler at the end of my road, at the end of our street. So I didn't mind taking the little bit of cash that I earned and putting it into the Pine Barrens. I thought it was very well worth it. And that was before I knew that he was famous. Because then, if I'd known he was famous, I probably would have paid him $30 each time. And it would have been good. But he wrote this book, The Tracker, and all of a sudden he was famous. And he was at the tracker school because he started it right around that time. And we had all these license plates from all over the country, and I was terrified of all these strangers, and I wondered why this barn was filled with people, and I, you know, to hear this guy talk. And then I was hanging around the fire during the dinner time, and people were talking about prophecies that they'd all heard, and they were talking about all these end of the world prophecies. And if you want to hear end of the world prophecies, hang out at a fire at the tracker school. And from 1978 until probably the last time I hung out at a fire at the tracker school was probably around, yeah, I don't know, 2007 or 2008. I hung around there a little bit. I've probably heard more prophecies than you could even imagine. I heard so many world-ending prophecies, and they were all so unique and different and interesting. But in the meantime, I was watching the tide of life receding, you know, and to me that was more, it sort of came together in a way. You know, there was like sort of this spiritual end of the world approaching through all these prophecies, and then there was this tide of life receding at the same time. And then there was these people who were all interested in growing more buildings, you know, at the expense of the creeks and the streams and the frogs. And they were doing something else, which might seem really radical to you all, but it was really happening quite normally there. There was something like a 90-something percent subscriber rate to this chemical lawn care, which became a form of addiction, because if you subscribe to these companies, they had patented formulas, which meant patented genetically modified grass seeds that responded to their uniquely patented chemical formulas, which caused those plants to grow and nothing else to grow. So if you actually discontinued the service with them, your lawn would die entirely, because their little hybrid, which was dependent on their patented chemical, wouldn't survive without their regular fix, you know. And the fix was a mixture of pesticides and herbicides and fertilizers, which, of course, were going where? To the creek, which was going into the reservoir, which was our drinking water. And, like, to me, the whole thing was really, strange. I couldn't even believe that people didn't realize there was something wrong with this picture, but they didn't. And whenever I complained, they just told me I was like a doomsday guy. And I was like, no, I'm not a doomsday guy, but I've fished here for a long time, and I never caught a fish with the growth coming out of its eyeball before, you know. Mm-hmm. And I stopped fishing at that point because I went to one of my favorite fishing holes and caught a fish with this weird hand-shaped growth coming out of its eyeball. And I, you know, I was like, wow. So maybe all these prophecies are really happening, you know. And that this is, I can't pick a prophecy because they're all really compelling. They're somewhat in conflict with each other, but, you know, we have a unique ecology of prophecy. Great diversity. As we were losing biodiversity, we were gaining prophecy diversity. And it all was kind of dark and scary, but some of it was really sort of sci-fi, but some of it I took... Because in my heart, I could feel something in it. Like, there would be these people who would show up at the tracker school dinner fires who didn't take the classes but would come to talk to people around these fires. It was like they were messengers from other fires. And I'll never forget when this Hopi guy showed up and was talking about Hopi prophecies. And he had told me something that was eerily close to the Tolkien book that I read when I was 15. And he was basically saying that we are living in the time when Grandmother Spider would weave webs of deception over land, sea, and sky. It would be as if she went crazy. Because in their stories, Grandmother Spider helped make the universe. You know, Grandmother Spider was one of the positive creation spirits that helped create life and weave the web of life. And they said it was as if she went out of control, out of her mind, essentially. And she was weaving webs of deception over land, sea, and sky. And that anyone who was caught in these webs of deception would more or less, you know, be sort of paralyzed. But there would be certain people who would be able to walk on the webs, he was saying. They would have this strange ability to hear drumbeats through the web. Drumbeats. And these drumbeats would be coming from ants. And the ants would be playing the drums. And you could hear the beats through the drum and through the web. And you would know that somebody else was awake on the other side of the web, and they would be talking to you through the web. And you could then go in the web and find people that were stuck. You could catch them and bring them back to the earth and use earth ceremonies to bring them back to themselves, because that's all that would work. And it sounded so much like Tolkien, you know. I had to ask him a lot of questions to see if he'd got it from The Lord of the Rings, you know. Actually, The Hobbit. But he insisted that he hadn't, that these were teachings from his ancestors. And I was then going to anthropology at Rutgers University, so I had access to some stuff. And I didn't find a direct reference to what he was talking about, but I found a lot of stuff that was very similar. So I realized this really could be, you know. And I thought, wow, it's why am I the person sitting here listening to this story? Why has this man come here and found me at this fire, and I listened to him? Well, you know, I studied conservation ecology as part of my work at university, which was basically looking at the web of life receding from as many different disciplines as science could possibly offer, which meant, you know, kind of end of the world prophecies from the science point of view, you know. And then I was at the tracker school in my summers getting the other prophecies, and can you imagine how helpless a person could feel? I was getting really, really hopeless. I was really, really hopeless and really worried about my world and our world, really. But I wasn't sure if there would be a future, you know. And I was also really alarmed at the fact that most everybody in the adult world was in complete disagreement with it. I wouldn't say denial, because I wasn't 100% convinced I wasn't the crazy one. Because it kind of felt like I was the only one who was worried about this at the level that I was worried about it. But I guess I was probably one of the only people who was getting science prophecies and tracker school campfire prophecies in such diversity. And I don't recommend that. Don't put those things in your kids' courses. Doesn't go well. The end result of all this was that I needed some peace of mind, and I was, I guess I had to wait a while. You know, I graduated college in 83, and and by the way, somewhere around 78 also, I read one hopeful piece of writing. Do you know what it was? In 78, it showed up in my freshman dorm, and someone dropped it on me, and I don't even know who, I can't remember where I got it. It was dropped on me in 1978, and it was the only hopeful thing I found. Any guesses? No matter how random, what are you seeing? Stranger in a Strange Land. Stranger in a Strange Land, that's good.
Jonathan Livingston.
Oh, I actually read that at 15.
Okay, Picture of Capra?
No.
Eileen Caddy.
What did you say?
Eileen Caddy.
You're warm.
Dorothy.
Dorothy. You're getting warmer. You're getting warmer. Each time you've gone up a factor.
David Spangler. Spangler.
Oh, now you're really warm.
Not it.
Yes, The Magic of Finhorn. In 1978, I read The Magic of Finhorn. And it was like this, in the darkness from science and the darkness from prophecy, was this little glimmering light that was shining. And I thought, oh my God, is this for real? You know, but I consumed that book, just consumed it. And I've not been to Finhorn before last March, just a couple of months ago. You know, so for me, it was a long time coming to come to Finhorn, you know. Who was over at Finhorn with me that time? There's quite a few of you there, yeah. It was really nice. I met some of you there. So I tell you this because it sort of led to something. You know, I decided that if Finhorn could talk to spirits in nature and grow big cabbages, that eventually I would find a way to put a sweat lodge in my garden and try to bring the tide of life back. You know, that's kind of what I was thinking. Like, could I somehow like put the energy back in the land that was going away through the sweat lodge tradition that I was taught? And I started doing that in about 1981, 82, actually my own conscious, intentional sweat lodges in my garden to see if I could grow giant cabbages. I did grow giant ragweed. These things were unbelievable. I think if the county agricultural agent saw it, I would have been arrested as a public health menace. And that had to do with our compost, for sure. So in 1990, I finally found peace with the whole prophecy thing. When, and I think I've been through several world ends. Remember 1984? That was one of the first ones. And the tracker school business really spiked just before 1984. And you wouldn't believe the world-ending prophecies just before 1984. And then they went away and it kind of calmed for a while. And then, how many world endings were there? We just passed another one, yeah. By the way. And every time another world ending comes, the tracker school's business goes really up high, and then it mellows out afterwards. But the end of the world is very good for the tracker school. And the classes fill, and they have waiting lists and stuff like that. And we were tracking the economy early in the story, so I figured I'd keep the economy as part of the conversation. But we have another one coming up here December next year. Open your survival school. I mean, even if you only open it just for 3 months. You know? September, October, November, people are going to panic at the last minute. You could even just put up posters. Are you sure? That's all you have to say. Learn survival skills. Anyway, you're all practicing that stuff, so you might as well make some money on it. But all that aside, you know, there is this thing that happens in between these peaks and valleys of panic, you know, for the end of the world coming. So I was really kind of still thinking about all these doom and gloom things that were coming towards us, you know, and I finally met this elder who took the pressure off of me. And I've been carrying it for a while, you know, probably since 11, 12 years, I was carrying this pressure of doom and gloom and wondering which one of these many scenarios would come to be. And I met this elder named Jake Swamp. And there was a number of us who'd been sort of affected by this prophecy thing. And we asked him, well, what prophecies, gloom and doom, do you guys have? Because he must have them. All the other Indians have them. So what are yours, you know, and how are we going to die, you know? And Jake said, well, he said, you know, we don't look at it like that. And I kind of had a double take. What are you talking about? You don't look at it like that. And he says, well, we never look. You know, maybe we used to look at it a long time ago that way, but the peacemaker came along and he kind of instructed us that, you know, that we, as human beings, are creative power. You know, the Creator placed powers in us as creators so that we have creativity, and that if you don't mind your creativity, you'll create what you hold in your mind, you know, is pretty much what he was saying. Laws of attraction, essentially, he was saying, you know, and he was sort of telling me all about laws of manifestation, but he was saying that these were thousand-year-old principles, you know. And that the leadership, and he was one of the leaders, he was one of the 50 chiefs of his circle. And you cannot believe what these guys have to go through to become a chief, what barriers they have to pass, and what integrity they have to show, and what humility and spiritual awareness and wisdom they have to carry before they're even allowed to be thought of, you know. And they're sort of tapped 5 years before they're elected, and they're elected by the women who are called the clan mothers, who are these noble, wise women in the tribe, who are the only ones who have the right to elect chiefs, you know. And so it's a really profound journey that these guys go on to become chiefs. And when they get to be, and by the way, the word chief is our translation of their word, which doesn't translate to chief at all. It translates to noble man, basically. The clan mothers keep a close eye on them, and if they get out of line, they get immediately impeached, pulled right out by the clan mothers. So These are people of very high integrity. But one of the things that they have going on is that they're initiated in this path of leadership. And they're essentially told that once you take this position and you accept the chief, that you don't have to, by the way, if the clan mothers nominate you and want to put you up, you don't have to say yes. And the clan mothers fully expect you to say no. Because when you are finally put in office, which we might call inauguration in our world, right? They call it condoling. They actually grieve for you when they put you in office, because when you're put in office, you've just given up your other life. Your personal life is gone, so you have to grieve the loss of who you were before you were put in this position, because you will not live for yourself anymore. From this point on, you will be fully in service to the people, and that's it. Until you die, basically. That's how you get out of office. It's a pretty strong training that they're doing, like, you know, sort of Jedi training for these people to put them in their positions of power. But when you look at what they're doing with them, you start to look at your own system of governance with a little bit of a question mark, or maybe a big one. Because the leadership is trained in this manner. They say, your mind only can function in two ways. There's only two possibilities for your mind. This is what they say. Okay, so you don't have to believe this. Remember, this is theirs. But let it be a mirror to just think about it, right? Your mind is either in two states, and there's no other states possible. You're either in the upright mind, or you're in the deteriorating mind, and there's nothing in between. So, you ready to be haunted for the rest of your life? Mm-hmm. If you have the upright mind, that means that you're a creative person who's leading the people and bringing positive change into the future. If you're in the deteriorating mind, you are essentially being caught by past patterns or grief or old things that are caught inside your brain, and you're basically spinning negativity, right? So you can't lead with a deteriorating mind. So if the clan mothers detect that you have a deteriorating mind, they'll actually pull you out of office temporarily and send you to the healers. And the healers will work you over until they can clear your past and get you back into creativity, because you can't have a leader. Listen to this quote. You can't have a leader whose minds are down around their ankles. Right? And they say, if your mind is down around your ankle, when you try to walk forward for your people, you fall. So they actually don't even allow the leaders to have their own state of mind. Inside their skull belongs to the people also. Think about that, you know? It's like you are basically signing on to the upright mind. And they put it another way. They said, you know, not only leadership should have the upright mind. They basically model the upright mind because all the young people look to them and will imitate what they do. So they want to make sure that they, as the public figures who are standing before the people, are the ones with the upright mind, so that the kids know what upright mind looks like and then they can move towards it also. So the hope is that with enough upright mind people in positions of power and leadership, that the next generation will be inspired for people to rise with the upright mind. So it actually works. You know, it's a cultural mentoring principle. And they say that if a community has a critical mass of people in the upright mind, it will regenerate positively, and there'll be a future, a hopeful future. If too many people are in the deteriorating mind, they will be a burden to society. So you when you grow old with the upright mind, you're an elder and you're an asset to the community. If you grow old with the deteriorating mind, you become a burden and you become a cost to people, because people have to take care of you, and you're very needy and asking and demanding a lot, and creating a lot of mischief with your negative thoughts. So I always found that fascinating, that a government could evolve to that level. You know, that's how they think of their leadership. Because, boy, I just watch our American government and I just shake my head. It's like the almost polar opposite of what I'm talking about right now. Even in the way they campaign, you know, it's just disturbing to me. But that said, back to Jake and prophecy. So now you might understand why he says this about prophecy. Now, we don't really see prophecy as an absolute prediction of the end of the world. We see it as a sign of what could happen if you continue on your current trends. And it's a warning from nature trying to tell you the course that you're on. It's like it's a street sign that's telling you that you need to not get off that exit, but take this one instead. You know, it's just a way to understand, he said, who you are in history, where you are in history, and what your responsibilities are as an individual. So you're meant to see these prophecies, use them as a mirror, find your creativity, and rise to the occasion. And that's their purpose. He said, every generation has had prophecies. I said, as far back as the peacemaker's time, more than 1,000 years ago, we remember that every generation has prophecies. And they're not the end of the world. They're the end of the generation that's currently in existence, this world. And that's all they are, and that's all they've ever been, and that's all they'll ever be, as far as we know. The Creator tells us who the next children are coming by the prophecies that they receive. That was the only hopeful thing I ever heard about prophecy. And maybe because I don't want all those other ones to come true, or maybe because I lived through so many world endings, you know, that were prophesied in Technicolor, I latched onto that one and began to take ownership of it as my way of thinking about things. Like, it's the only thing that gets me up in the morning is the recognition that I have a responsibility, that there's a lot of little children running around us right now who look to us to have an upright mind. And the moment you realize that, you're not going to let your mind go down around your ankles, because they need us to have an upright mind. It was Ingwe who said to me, in 1984, right in time for George Orwell's world end, which was well backed up. It had background singers at the Tracker School fire. I mean, it wasn't just George Orwell. There was all kinds of corresponding ones. You know, there was ETs that were going to come. There was lots of things that were going to happen around 1984. So just don't blame it on George Orwell. But Ingwe said to me, you know, I gave him 250 papers from high school sophomores. These are 14, 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds at the latest. And they were reading through I gave them these five questions that I was asking them, and the last two questions were, what's the biggest problem in the world today? And the last question, what can you do to solve the problem? I was curious to see what they were thinking about this stuff. Part of it was something to do with me wondering why no one noticed the springs going away and the animals disappearing. Like, these were my neighbors. These kids were from my neighborhood. And these 250 kids consistently answered the last question the same, essentially, which I didn't really perceive at first, but they were unified in their answer to question number five. Question number four, they were there was patterns, okay? One was nuclear war, one was disease, one was starvation, one was overpopulation. So they had their patterns of how the world would end that they were all seeing. And the other thing that they had was a consistent answer, which boiled down to, if you took all of their responses to question number five and added them together and divided them by 250, you would get one answer, which basically said, it's too late, there's nothing I can do, right? You know, the other thing you heard, which was a slight variation on that, was, I'm just me, there's nothing I can do, I'm too small, I can't make a difference.
When was this?
What's that?
When was that?
1984. Yeah, and I don't know if they even knew who George Orwell was. Well, I had been trying to figure out how to get Ingwe out of retirement. He, at that point, he was probably 72, and I really wanted him to help us with the Wilderness Awareness School model because he had this extraordinary background, and I really knew we needed elders. It was really clear to us we needed elders to lead us, you know. I couldn't get him to budge. But he read those papers while he was in the hospital. He fell off a chair and cracked a rib and collapsed a lung and had all those tubes in his arm. And I came to visit him, and I dropped the papers with him and gave him a muffin and some fresh-made coffee from our restaurant. And he really appreciated that. And he was sitting there just kind of, thanks for the reading, you know. And I said, they're young people wrote this thing, but you might be interested. So he called me up a little while later, and when the phone rang, I was by myself in the restaurant, which was just below the hospital, like a block away from it, and it was quiet, and it was the afternoon. I was standing at the deli case by the cash register, and all of a sudden this phone rings, and it was like shock, you know, like, whoa, what is that? Like, scared me, you know, but the phone always rings at this restaurant, but it really scared me, and I picked up the phone, and I said, Alan the Fiddler, Natural Foods Restaurant, and he says, John, get up here right away, it's important. Click. Right? I was like, uh-oh, you know? So I ran to the hospital at that point, and I ran in the stairwell. I didn't go by the little guy at the front desk where you have to get the little piece of thing that says you're allowed to go to the hospital floor where he was. I just ran up the stairwell and got to his room, and I come in there, and when I saw him last, he was all white and pasty, and he was just kind of laying there kind of like all weak and, you know, happy for the coffee, but just looking really defeat it, you know. And I just kept thinking about this guy raising his children in the wilderness in Eastern Africa, you know, just surrounded by huge game herds and tribesmen, and when his kids got wounds that needed stitches, he stitched them, you know, built his house out of rammed earth, you know, just lived far from any civilization for such a long time. He and his wife were so, they were such settlers of the pioneers, you know, like this crazy tough bunch, you know. And here he was looking all pasty and defeated and white, like kind of like pale. Like normally he had this bright color in his skin and his eyes were flashing, but he had this big hole in his arm where a lion bit him and the other side was bulging out. And he's laying there in the bed. And here's the irony, you know, the lioness didn't take him out. You know, he's still here. And yet here he is defeated, looking like this weak thing with tubes in his arms, you know, and it just seems so sad to me. I just was watching this, like, this would be a terrible end of you, Ingwe, if you pass on right here, you know. I didn't say that, of course, but I left him those papers, and that's what he was reacting to. And when I came up in the room, he was sitting up, and he looked like that scene where King Kong's trying to break out of his chains, right? And he's sitting up, and he's shaking, and he's got these papers in his hands, and he's going through them, and he's just, listen, nothing, it's too late, I'm too small, and he's just reading like this. And then he just takes all of the papers, and he just throws them down, and he says, these young people have no hope, he says, right? He says, we can't let them have no hope, they'll lead us right into ruin. These are our future leaders, and they have no hope, right? And he said, I'm coming out of hospital. They want me to stay here. I'm coming home tomorrow, and we're going to give them hope. Like this, right? And I'm joining you with Wilderness Awareness School. And that's, and he called me the next day and said, come on, let's go. Let's get to work. Right? And then I didn't just have an elder. I had a boss, you know. It was really different, but it was really good. You know, and he was dead serious about that. Can you see that principle also coming through him? The understanding that you can't have a healthful future if you don't hold a picture for it in your mind. Because we, being creative beings, will create what we hold in our mind, which is the danger of these prophecies. Mm-hmm. Why they shouldn't be taken as the seed for your mind's eye, they should be taken as the mirror to help you develop the power of your mind's eye. You know, they're not meant to be implanted inside here. They're meant to be held at a distance so that you can figure out why you were born. And that was the message from Jake. But Ingwe totally agreed. Jake and Ingwe saw eye to eye. I think the only reason Jake would have worked with us in the first place was because we had Ingwe on our team. You know, when Jake realized who our boss was, he stuck around and worked with us for 10 solid years, teaching us peacemaking, which is a tremendous gift to our work. And it's built into Art of Mentoring. So if you're wondering if we'll teach it to you, we've been teaching it to you all along. It's built in. So the last thing I wanted to say about that, and then I wanted to give it to Margot to share a story related to all of this, is that at a certain point, there was a return of the Hopi message to me that said there was going to be those who could walk in the web without getting caught, and they would be the ones who would have that ability to rescue people. And I had a vision of that in 1980 in the Pine Barrens, near a place called the Medicine Waters, where I was raised to learn tracking. And I began to understand that, you know, in this time that we're living in, the people who are caught in the spider's web may not know they're caught in the spider's web. And that the people who have developed deep nature connection have almost like a medicine to prevent that venom from taking too much of a hold of you, you know. And you have this responsibility to almost be like a rescue worker, to go into a war-torn land and find the people who are still making noise, you know, in the rubble, and to bring them to their sit spot and help them make that connection ultimately. You know, and there's a woman named Deb Winters who's on the treasury of the Nature Connection Mentoring Foundation, and who was the CFO for Allenlink Media, our company, for many years, 16 years. And the reason she's so dedicated to working with us is because she comes from multiple broken families. Many of her siblings had a really hard life, and a couple of them are in jail. One of them committed suicide and left all these orphan kids. And she's been the one to raise them. And she's the one who sees the hardship that the young people are facing, because she's the one who catches all their stories. And she saw the only place where they ever found hope was working with the Nature Connection stuff that was going on, the Art of Mentoring and the peacemaking, you know. But that's where they were able to nourish and overcome the darkness of their family situation. And she said, you know, I've always seen the work we're doing as the Red Cross for a war-torn world that doesn't know there's a war, you know. And that stuck with me. And she was one of the people who made me never give up, because I saw her not giving up. Because if she